You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey, are you looking for a collaborator for your next show? Maybe you're a composer looking for a lyricist or a book writer looking for a composer. We now have a writer database on the Producers Perspective Pro of 150 writers strong looking to work with you. Check it out at theproducersperspectivepro.com. It's the only writer database of its kind. Now on with the podcast.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Producers Perspective Podcast. I am Ken Davenport, my guest today, the Tony Award-winning set designer, Mr. Derek McClain. Welcome, Derek.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So Derek has designed a ton of Broadway shows and off-Broadway shows, from Fully Committed to Noises Off, Gigi, Beautiful, Nice Work If You Can Get It, Follies, and so many more, including he's a designer of my upcoming Getting the Band Back Together. Won a Tony for 33 Variations, a Drama Desk for Anything Goes, and get this, an Emmy Award for his design of the Oscars, which he's doing again this year, which we'll talk about. He's fresh off his design for Hairspray Live. I actually used his parking spot when I was interviewing Ken Leone for this podcast. So thank you very much for that parking
Anytime.
Spot. Thank you for being here. So let's just start off with this. What came first, your love of the theater or your love of designing stuff?
My love of designing stuff. When I was a kid, I thought maybe I would become an architect. And I used to sort of make little models of greenhouses. And I also used to make elaborate aquariums in my basement. The aquariums were made entirely from scratch, so the sides were made out of plywood with one plate of glass in the front. And the problem was that the plywood usually leaked. But it wasn't really about putting water in them. It was about making scenes inside these boxes. That was the thing that did me. I didn't know anything about set design. I'd never even really heard of it. And I worked construction as a summer job between high school and college, and then again during the summer breaks in college. So somebody asked me to build a set when I was in college because I had this construction experience. And I did that, but I immediately thought, wow, wouldn't it be cool to design one of these things? And so I started to do that. I went to Harvard as an undergraduate, and at the time there was no theater program, so it was completely just an extracurricular activity. And the good thing is that I got to design a lot of shows. The downside was that I had absolutely no skills. I didn't really know how to say, create a piece of period architecture on stage, anything like that. Anyway, that's how I got my start.
And how old were you when you started designing the aquariums? I'm always curious as to your instincts come out.
Gosh, I don't know, probably 12 or 13.
And the first show?
I'd always made things all my life. I mean, I'd always been a person who made little, you know, model airplanes and rockets and junk like that.
Were you a model rocketry kid?
Well, no, not really. I was never really that into the kits. I was more into making them from scratch. I remember when I was about 5 or 6 making a rocket out of paper and leaves. And I was convinced that because you could light the leaves on fire, that the thing was going to shoot up in the air and blast off into space. And I remember my dad gently telling me that it would be okay if this rocket didn't actually take off.
And what was the first show that you designed in college that someone said, hey, will you build this for us? The first show?
Well, the first thing I built was the musical version of Two Gentlemen of Verona. And the first thing that I designed was a production of Guys and Dolls, which was in a dining room at college. And it was in the corner of a dining room. And I was very proud of it. And I kind of cringe now when I think about what I did.
So when you said you didn't have the skills to design a set, what are those skills? What does a set designer need to have? If I decide I'm going to do this tomorrow, what do I need to know?
Well, you know, it really depends on the project. So there were certain shows that I was able to pull off without any of the sort of traditional design skills that were just completely conceptual things. I did a lot of work with the director, Peter Sellers, when I was in college. A lot of those things didn't really require traditional drawing skills, but, you know, in order to sort of think bigger or to think, say, you know, to be able to have ideas that were in a particular period that used a period of architecture or things that, you know, sort of engaged in real fantasy, that required, you know, a bunch of other skills that I didn't have, like the ability to look at a piece of research and figure out, you know, if I wanted a really elaborate period door, and I wanted to have that built on stage, I didn't know how to get from the piece of research to the thing on stage, because there's certain sort of skills that, you know, you can learn, you can be taught that help you do that. Or even the, you know, the ability to figure out how to do a multi-scene musical and how to make that fit into a theater and all the kind of stuff that goes along with that. So a lot of that stuff is drawing based. And what happened when I was an undergraduate was I met the designer Marco Jurgen, and I told him, you know, I wanted to be a set designer professionally, and I said, what should I do? And he said, well, you should probably go to Yale. You should probably go to Yale Drama School. He was on the faculty at Yale. And he looked at my portfolio, such as it was, and he said, you know, what you really, really need to do is learn to draw. So sketch well. And I was sort of surprised to hear that. And he said, you know, if you design no more plays and spend all of your time between now and going to try to apply to graduate school just drawing, you'd be in much better shape. So you've designed plenty of plays, and now you need to really learn to draw. And so I enrolled in some of the drawing classes. Well, I enrolled in the prerequisite drawing class that I had at Harvard, which was called Drawing 10. And it was an absolutely miserable class that insisted that you spend the first 6 months drawing squares and circles and learning to draw them neatly, which really has nothing to do with being able to draw well or see well or any of those things. And so I ended up taking my drawing classes at the Cambridge Center for Adult Education in the evening, where they had real art classes.
I love it. He drops Harvard for the local art school.
Yeah, the local art school was actually, those were real art classes. And we did life drawing, and they had some, you know, they had good instructors there. And so I did that pretty intensively until the time I tend to apply to Yale. And then when I applied to Yale, Ming-Cho Lee was the head of the program there. He still is. And Ming-Cho Lee looked at my portfolio, and he said, well, he said, if you promise to keep studying drawing from now until September, we will accept you.
I had no idea that the actual sketching was such an important part of the design. I always thought you guys were sitting down at an architecture drawing board and measuring it out with rulers and all sorts of things.
Well, that's certainly a part of it. And that's a part of it that, you know, I can have an associate do. But the actual sketching is really valuable in a bunch of ways. It's, you know, it's a little bit like writing is to a writer. It's sort of a basic tool. So when I sit in a meeting with a director, there's always a pad of paper and a pencil or a pen. And I sketch during the meeting. And those sketches are not necessarily beautiful. They're not presentation sketches, but they are a part of the dialogue. They're a part of the conversation. Well, what if it looked like this? Or what if we did a thing that was like this? Or, you know, oh, but what if it was like this? And the ability to communicate that way is hugely, hugely important. So just sort of as a way of basically developing basic ideas, it's really important. And then further to that, it's really useful for me, and I think for a lot of designers, in terms of your own process when you are trying to work out a design and you're trying to figure out what you want it to look like. Sometimes you meet a play and you imagine exactly what it should look like and you go, I know what this is going to be. But that doesn't happen all the time. And there are plenty of times when you start on a project and you read it and you go, I don't know what the hell this should be. Or you read the play and you understand what the playwright has described, but it's not, you know, it might seem sort of overly literal or uninspired if you just sort of did that and you want to try to take it to the next level. And the way you do that is by drawing it. You know, I always find that if I'm working on a project that I don't know what to do and I'm stuck and there's always a deadline looming at some point, the first thing I do is I just sit down with some paper and I just draw whatever it is the play seems to demand. So if it's a plane or room, I just, you know, figure out what the description is. Maybe there is a written description by the playwright, and I literally just draw that onto a piece of paper. And this is usually a painful process for me because it looks terrible. It looks like nothing. But then you look at it and you go, well, how do I make that better? And then you draw it again. And then you draw it again and you realize something else and you go, what if I did that? And you draw it a third time. And then, you know, and none of those drawings might be anything you ever show to anybody else, but they are part of the process of developing a design. That's sort of the craft of building a design, especially when you don't have a sudden inspiration. You know, I think it's false to think that inspiration strikes and saves the day every single time. A lot of times you just have to roll up your sleeves and do the work. And the drawing is what helps you do that work. It's what lets you do that work.
So I love this idea that you sit down with the director and just sketch and free associate as you meet. Is it challenging sometimes for you? How many times does an author or director come to you and be like, Derek, I want you to design my show. I know exactly what it should look like. Here, do this. Do you find that happens a lot? Can you work that way? What's that process like for you?
I have found that happens sometimes. And if it's a good idea and it works, I'm all for it. There's no reason not to do it.
What happens when it's a bad idea?
Well, usually you find that out when you start to execute it, you know. So, you know, if something is a bad idea, you might just talk about it and talk about, you know, whether that would really work. Or you might just try drawing it and say, look at it and go, not really working so great. But then you can also draw something that might work better. It really depends. You know, sometimes there are lots of directors who come with ideas and sometimes they end up in the ideas that are on stage, or sometimes they develop into something else, or sometimes they're the genesis for the next idea. It completely depends on the project.
I love how I'm going to show you what it's going to look like, or work it out, or I'm going to draw it, I'm going to do something about it. And writers, I think, have a more difficult time sometimes. Oh, I'm going to try this, I'm going to try this. That process getting really gets the idea out there for sure.
You know, I heard B.F. Skinner speak, the behavioral psychologist, when I was in college, and he gave a talk on writing, which I went to. And he said, so the big challenge for every writer is how do you get started? You know, how do you make yourself write? And what if I have nothing to say? Or what if I can't make good sentences? And his belief was it didn't matter that you just wrote anyway. And you just, even if you wrote badly, you wrote because the process of writing caused you to write better. And, you know, because he was a behavioral psychologist, he believed in writing in the same time every day in the same room. So he had a place that was just for writing, not for anything else. And he would write, he liked to write quite early. I think he said he would start at 4:30 in the morning, something like that, and write from 4:30 to 9 every day. And he said the thing that happened for him was that by doing it regularly in the same room, he became faster and faster at getting started. That there was something about the stimulus of walking into that room at that particular hour that caused him to start writing. So I always think of that, and I think, well, you know, a lot of the same things can apply to drawing. And it's to sit there and say you don't have any ideas or it all sucks is self-indulgent, really. I mean, that might be true, but, you know, at the end of the day, you just have to roll up your sleeves and do it.
What's the most misunderstood thing about designing set that the average layperson would be surprised to hear?
You know, I think a lot of people don't realize how many choices are made in design. You know, for example, you know, they don't necessarily understand how even choices about how the audience is seated is often part of the set design. Sometimes designers move the seats around, they move the audience around different parts of the theater. I think a lot of times the audience assumes, especially in musicals, that a lot of the stuff, the apparatus, was sort of there as a part of the theater. I've heard that from a lot of people. You know, when I give them tours of sets for musicals, and I'm explaining, for example, what the show deck is, or if I'm saying, you know, explaining how we put this turntable in, they go, "Oh, really? I thought I just assumed the turntable came with the theater. There was always a turntable here." And I think people are surprised to learn how incredibly bare bones, you know this because you've been in a million empty theaters, how there's nothing there when you go in, when there's not a show there. It is absolutely stripped bare. And so that everything that goes on stage is part of that design.
You talk about audiences being seated or moving the seats around. Do you think, and we have an example of that on Broadway this year,
right,
with Natasha Pierre, do you see this as a trend? Is there going to be more of that in Broadway houses, do you think?
Probably. I mean, it's not... You know, I probably these things go in cycles. It was also big in the 70s. What was it? Candide, I think, was, you know, famous for this. But there were a lot of very environmental productions that were mounted in the 70s. And a lot of theaters started to be built in the 70s that were flexible. So, you know, not Broadway theaters, but other theaters where you could, you know, it was deliberately built without fixed seating so that you could move them around. But right now there's definitely an interest in environmental productions and experiential productions, less so on Broadway than elsewhere. But, you know, those productions elsewhere have an influence on what happens on Broadway for sure. Like Natasha Pierre, which started, you know, in a tent. And the results of that sort of experiment wound up on Broadway. But I think that there probably will be more of that.
Some of the biggest hits that Broadway has ever produced are these giant spectacles, Phantom of the Opera, Lion King, Wicked, etc. Do you think Broadway shows have to be big? Is there a certain level that they size that they have to be successful for a commercial audience?
I don't think so. I think if you look at, say, Jersey Boys, which had a really long, successful run, that was a very, very simple production. It had production, and it had, you know, there were things that moved, but it wasn't a sort of physical extravaganza. It was about, you know, it was about those four guys, really. And it felt like a kind of real storytelling event on stage. I think Hamilton is another example. It's all designed. It's all beautifully designed, but it is extremely simple. I don't think people think of that as an extravagant physical production. So I think Broadway embraces the kind of full spectrum of experiences, like the ones you described, which really are, you know, extravaganzas and big expensive productions, to things that are much simpler productions.
You work a lot on Broadway and a lot off Broadway as well.
Yeah.
If you could only work in one of those environments for the rest of your career and they both paid the same, which would you choose and why?
I just say, I mean, certainly there's more experimentation off Broadway, but I do like aside from the fact that it pays better, the other thing I like about Broadway is that more people see it. And off-Broadway is limited in that way, that, you know, even the successful off-Broadway shows are going to be seen by probably 200 people, maybe 300 people a night. So it's just a different scale of work. I do like, you know, I mean, what we do is public, it's public storytelling, and we do like other people to share in it. And there is something satisfying about knowing that a lot of people have seen it, but a lot of people have shared in it.
What attracts you to a project? You're an unbelievably in-demand designer. How do you choose which show to do? Is it based on what you can do with the set? You're like, oh man, I can design one heck of a set for this thing, even though the show is like, meh, I don't know how good the show is, or is it show-based?
It's more show-based and it's more relationship-based. I mean, there are certain directors that I work with a lot, and, you know, I want to do all of their projects. And that sometimes includes projects that are more successful and projects that are less successful. And that's just, you know, it's part of a roller coaster ride. But if I had to choose between two projects that, you know, one I thought had a spectacular set versus, you know, the other, which I thought was a really, really good show, I'd probably choose the thing that was a really, really good show. Because, Nobody really ultimately wants to see a bad show.
You said there are certain directors you want to do all their projects. What makes one of those, a director one of those people?
Oh, I think it's just, you know, it's kind of a level of mutual trust that, you know, we enjoy an experiment. We enjoy trying something on a show, seeing how that turns out, and, you know, have the ability to build on that and go, we tried this idea on this show. That was interesting. But what if we tried, you know, what if we tried something completely different on something else? It's a lot easier to make bold choices, you know, with people that trust you than it is with people you've never worked with before, because there's always a level of gamble and risk for those things.
Biggest change you've seen in designing sets in the last 20 years?
Well, this goes back to your earlier question. I think that there is, in some ways, that there's a movement towards simpler productions in the commercial theater. I think that there's been more of an embrace of commercial projects that are very, very simple. I don't know, that probably came about partly because of the economics. So, you know, it's not really possible to spend $2 million on every set for every musical. There's some shows that just aren't built that way. So I guess I'd say that's definitely a trend. I think, you know, the style of what people want to see right now has changed also. It used to be, you know, there were so many shows that were very heavily period. In the 80s, there were a lot of really heavily period musicals. And I think those are, they're less in vogue now. They're certainly still period musicals, but they're not, I don't think they're done with such a heavy, with such a sort of heavy literal sense of a period.
Where do you see set design going? Where do you see it? What do you see it looking like in 20 years from now? Big spectacles again, minimalistic, all projections.
You know, I kind of doubt it will be all projections. I mean, people have done, we've already had experiments with all projections, and we'll probably will have more of them. But at the end of the day, you know, projections are just pictures. They're not necessarily, the projections by themselves are not really a great environment for actors usually, because they are just pictures. So I think there's always going to be a need and a desire for that human connection that you get with real textured spaces. Not real, but textured spaces that are places that actors can touch and respond to. But where will it go? I don't know.
You've done a lot of work on television. You've done the Oscars. You just did Hairspray. What's the difference between designing a set that an audience is going to see in 3D and see those textures versus one that's going to be on a screen and flat?
You know, the difference, I guess, in designing, say, a musical for television or film, as a designer, you don't really control what the audience is going to see to the same degree. You know, on Broadway, a Broadway stage, or an off-Broadway stage, basically, you know, most of the audience is seeing the set from one particular point of view, and that's known. You know, on TV, the audience's view is constantly moving. It's, and you're seeing it from a lot of different angles, and you're seeing it from far away and up close. So it has to have a whole other level of detail. In some cases, like in the case of the Hairspray that I just did, because the camera moved so much, and it moved from set to set, and it moved in and out of the sets, and it, you know, there's so much that was done with Steadicam that would rotate 360 degrees around. It wasn't so much about designing a picture. You know, on Broadway, often you're designing, you know, a kind of a composed picture that where you composed in the sense that a painting is composed. Something like that on television, like in the Hairspray that I was just describing, you're really designing more of an environment that the piece can live in, and so that the camera can go wherever it wants.
The process by which sets are built on Broadway, so we go through this process where you design it, you give it to the general manager, give it to the shops, they bid it out, it goes back and forth. What do you think of this process?
Well, I guess that's a sort of necessary evil for a lot of productions. It works fine a lot of the time, but, you know, what would be ideal is if there's enough time that the designer and director and producers would sort of be able to look at the design and figure out what it is they want to do and how they want to do it, so that they're not sort of under the time crunch of getting bids back and getting a show awarded to a shop. You know, there's a thing that happens on some productions where, you know, by the time you get prices back and you're trying to sort of reconcile the costs of the set and the budget, you're up against the calendar. It gives you very, very little time to make good decisions. And I think that's you know, that's the thing that's most frustrating for me and pretty frustrating for a lot of directors is when your back is up against the wall. It's probably frustrating for producers too. You're faced with a situation where your back is up against the wall because of the calendar and you don't have time to go back and make new creative choices. You just have to figure out, you know, what to cut in order to get the show on budget. And I don't think anybody usually enjoys that very much.
No, from a producer's perspective, if you will, we hate to cut stuff.
Right.
I mean, no one wants to cut stuff. And
right.
We often find ourselves in these awkward, and you're right, time pressure situations. Like, we have to do it by tomorrow.
Right, exactly.
And it sometimes feels like I'm even telling designers, because you don't have time to rethink it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like cutting off a hand because it's gangrenous or
right.
something. It's like,
right.
It's an unfortunate thing. What's the favorite design that you've seen of a show that you haven't designed? Something you've seen where you're like, that's good.
Well, there are lots of them. There's always a couple every season that make me feel that way.
It can be from way back, too. Anything that's...
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorites ever was the set for Carousel that Bob Crowley did at Lincoln Center. I thought that was beautiful, beautiful, magical production. Was, you know, theatrical and transporting and surprising.
Your favorite set of your own? In other words, if the Smithsonian Institute called and said, we've got room for one of your models in our institute, which one would you choose?
Boy, that's hard. I'm always changing my mind about that. But I guess I'd have to say probably either 33 Variations or I Am My Own Life, one of those two. I thought both of those are really strong.
I will agree with you on that. Both of those were exceptional. I Am My Own Life was amazing.
Right there.
My last question, another James Lipton-like genie question. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to visit you and wants to thank you for your incredible contributions to the theater as a designer and says, what's the one thing that drives you crazy, Derek? What makes you bang the table, flip your drawing table up in the air, get really angry that you'd ask this genie to wish away in an instant about this industry? One thing makes you mad.
The one thing that makes me mad. You know, I guess... The thing that makes me maddest is when I've worked on a show that, you know, I and the other collaborators, you know, really works and it can't find an audience. That's incredibly frustrating. And it happens sometimes. It just, for whatever reason, doesn't catch on with the public. And that's a frustration. And I don't think I'm probably alone in being frustrated by that.
You're definitely not alone because I'm right there with you. What do you do when that happens? How do you
As a designer, there's really nothing I can do except, I suppose, try to get as many people that I care about to see it before it disappears. Because, you know, what we do is ephemeral. It doesn't last forever. And it's really only there in the moment. So if there's something that I do feel is special that's not going to last, then I want the people I care about to see it.
Well, thank you for that. We'll try to see what we can do with the genie to get that wished away.
Okay,
and all
good.
Shows will be successful. Then all the theaters
right.
will be filled and we'll never be able to do anything new. Thank you so much for being here. Thanks to all of you for listening. Good luck with the Oscars. We'll all be watching. See you next time, guys. Bye-bye.
Don't forget to check out the writer database on theproducersperspectivepro.com. 150 writers just waiting to work with you. Check it out at theproducersperspectivepro.com today.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.